Rome, gladiators, slaves, the Colosseum, birthplace of Christianity, the Rhodes, the greatest empire in the Western world, Caesars, the birthplace of the Republic, the fall of the Republic, and of course, fraud. We'll talk about that during this episode. Afternoon. As always, I'm your host, Gene Telsk. I'd like to welcome everyone to my White Collar Crime and Fraud podcast. And of course, I need to begin with an apology. I'm very sorry for the delay in getting this podcast back on track. I was in trial and a bunch of other things, of course, happened, which is normal for the life of a lawyer. So I've been away for a month. I really apologize to my listeners. I try not to let that happen, but sometimes life and especially work gets in the way. So I hope everybody had a good September. I'm really going to try and get out another podcast next week for the Halloween episode, which seems to be the recurring theme in this podcast. I actually intend it to be. So yes, we'll get that going as well. So once again, welcome to my White Collar Crime and Fraud podcast. I hope everybody is doing well. Getting back into things, I wanted to talk for this podcast about fraud in ancient Rome. As I've mentioned in many, many podcasts, fraud is it's part of human history. I probably said this once at one point, but it's certainly worth repeating, even if I have, that when the very first humans evolved over time, I'm sure one of these humans, early Cro-Magnons, defrauded another Cro-Magnon, probably a Neanderthals defrauded other Neanderthals. But anyway, that's going back a little bit too far for what we have here. But certainly, fraud is nothing new, and there's testimony of fraud going back all the way to ancient Egypt, but we're not going to go that far back. We're going to go back to the time of the late Roman Republic and later Empire. This is not a history podcast, so I don't have time to delineate the differences between the Roman Republic and the Empire, but safe to say that beginning in about 44 BC with the assassination of Julius Caesar, the Republic died out, and we became known as Rome became an empire under the rule of Caesar Augustus, beginning in about 27 BC. But we get the Western world gets its not only its history, but many of its traditions, its laws, its ethics, its morals, its words from the Roman Empire. Rome was certainly the most well-known, greatest, and longest-lasting of all the Western empires, and the Romans themselves inherited much of their civilization and philosophy from the ancient Greeks, and they were the first to admit it. So it's not surprising that since there was fraud, of course, in the Greek world, there was fraud in the Roman world as well. And the Roman Empire eventually, it started off, of course, with the city of Rome in what is today Italy, and the Roman Republic and later Empire expanded to cover the entire Mediterranean Sea, all the countries around the Mediterranean Sea, from Portugal all the way to Morocco. And in 180 AD was the greatest extent of the empire. And as I said, we get so much from Rome. There's many, many podcasts on Rome, the Roman Republic and Empire. If you're interested in that sort of thing, I highly recommend listening to them. Many of the words we get in the English language is from Rome. Although English is a Germanic language, we get much of our vocabulary from Latin. And certainly in the legal world, we get much of our expressions from Latin. I just had to use one this week for a client of mine, nolo contendere, no contest, which comes from Latin itself. So let's get started on fraud in the Roman world. And there's much to discuss on this, but I want to focus on a few things which I think are very interesting. Going back to about the year 50 BC in the Roman world, you had by this time the Republic was crumbling, but you had what was called a triumvirate, an informal political alliance among three prominent politicians, and this was known as the First Triumvirate. And these politicians were Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, or Pompey the Great, literally what that means. Gaius Julius Caesar, hopefully we don't need to go into discussion about who was Caesar, and Marcus Licinius Crassus. Crassus, we're going to talk about Crassus for this fraud. Crassus was an interesting figure. He was said to be the richest man in Rome and the richest Roman who ever lived. He was certainly very wealthy. If anybody has ever watched the movie Spartacus with Kirk Douglas, or the miniseries that was on Stars some years ago, I think it's still out there, once again by the name of Spartacus, the character of Crassus, Marcus Licinius Crassus, plays a very important role in the eventual defeat of the of Spartacus in what was called the Third Servile War. So Crassus was an interesting man. He, as I said, he was extremely wealthy. He entered into these political alliances. And he was known for, among his wealth, he was known not only for his wealth, but his abilities to continually build wealth. And he had a very interesting way, allegedly, of building wealth. The although the city of Rome, certainly by the time of the empire by 150, 160 AD, Rome, the city of Rome had about over a million people. And that was made Rome the largest city in the world during that time. And many wouldn't even reach the idea of another city with a million people for centuries after the fall of Rome. So it was a very, very large city. Strangely enough, though, Rome itself didn't have many of the conveniences that we, well, conveniences is perhaps too strong a word, but many of the social programs that we have today, and one of those being a fire department. You would think that a fire department would be necessary, but I guess people thought differently back then. Actually, there's a number of reasons why Rome never really had a fire department, but there was a private fire department that was run by Marcus Crassus. And whenever there was a fire in Rome, Marcus Crassus or one of his subordinates would organize a fire brigade to go put out the fire. Now, of course, although the Romans had a very extensive knowledge of hydraulics, certainly can be seen by their aqueducts and by their fountains. Just getting fire, getting water to a building that was burning into an area that was burning was very difficult. It was mainly done by human manpower. And of course, Rome being a very much a slave-based society, that was very easy to do. But anyway, the legends go, or the stories go, that Crassus, when he heard there was a fire, he would send out his own personal fire brigade. And of course, the fire brigade would get there and they would demand payment before they would put out the fire. So you can imagine that your house is burning down, or if you were a landowner or a property owner, your apartment tenement was built burning down. And lo and behold, here comes the fire brigade. I guess you would say praise Jupiter, or praise Venus, or praise Mars, whatever god you worshipped, I guess. And the fire brigade would arrive, and suddenly they would stretch out their hands saying, yeah, we can put out this fire. Of course, it'll cost you a little bit of denarii here, the Roman monetary source, but the Roman term for money. But yeah, we can put it out. So, of course, it's written that many people did indeed pay to have the fire put out. Now, is this a proper thing to do? Well, if you have a private fire brigade, I would argue certainly there's nothing wrong with having a fire. You know, if you're sending out your own fire brigade to demand payment of the fire for people, you're demanding payment for your fire brigade to put out the fire. The insurance was known in the Roman world as well, and we're actually going to be talking about that, not in this podcast, but it merits a separate podcast of all its own. But you could actually buy fire insurance. And so I guess, would the fire insurance have paid for one of Crassus's fire brigades to go out and put out the fire with payment in advance? Well, I guess that's a question for historians. And it's interesting. Anyway, also as well, which is allegedly, it's a rumor, but it's been debated by historians as well, which is sometimes there's questions as to whether or not Mark Crassus's underlings would set a fire. So in other words, you know, perform arson on a building and then send out its own fire brigade to put out the fire, of course, demanding payment up front, or demanding payment before the fire would be put out. Now, if this is the case, then certainly that would be fraud. In many ways, but it's interesting that as the centuries went on, a lot of legends sprung up about Marcus Crassus and his dealings, and whether there was a question as to if he would send out arsonist teams, what we would call today teams of arsonists, to set a fire and to demand payment for his own fire brigade to put it out. I think we'd all agree that would certainly qualify as fraud. It's interesting to speculate anyway. Marcus Crassus, as I said, did have an interesting life. He put down the Servile Revolt, the Spartacan Revolt against Rome. He eventually died, however. He thought he was a military commander. He really wasn't. He died in one of the wars against the Persians to the east of the Roman Empire. So that was the end of Marcus Licinius Crassus. But it is worth speculating just what would have happened if this continued. Anyway, I want to move on then to another form of fraud in the Roman Empire. And this was, this is actually a bit more severe because it's one of the reasons the Roman Empire fell apart. And it's also, as you might say, a warning for today's society. There's that old joke that history is, it's not even a joke, but history, for those who forget history, they're doomed to repeat it. And historians like to say, we don't forget history, but then we have to watch other people repeat it. So I guess it's something to keep in mind. But anyway, Roman currency, of course, was in use throughout the Roman world, the denarii and various coinage that was used by the Romans as the money that was used by the empire and the Republic and the empire. And this was the coinage that was used was, of course, the international currency, much as the dollar is used today as the international currency or the euro. The Romans had their own currency that was used. And Roman currency continued for centuries, if not millennia, if you count the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire. So Roman currency was used as the value system for buying and spending. And the actual Roman coinage was introduced by the Republican government, the Roman Republic, in about 290 BC. And the Roman currency was made of different types of metal. There was silver currency, gold currency, and this currency obviously had different denominations. And obviously gold currency was worth more than silver currency, which was worth more than currency, for example, that may have been made out of brass or bronze. And so, for example, you had gold coins that were known as an aureus, which were worth about 25 denarii, denarii being the standard unit of Roman currency. And aureus, as the name would suggest, was made out of gold. And this is a very high level of Roman denomination. And then you had a denarius, for example, which is where we get the term denarii from. And this could be made out of different metals, but usually it was made out of silver. And you had other types of currency as well. For example, the sestertius. Well, I did take quite a few years of Latin, but it is a bit rusty now. And this was made out of a metal called orichalcum. Or another type of currency was called an os, which is made out of bronze. And as can be seen here, the worth of the currency was based often on the metal itself. For example, the Romans used standard weights and measures, which were considered in voliat. That is to say, if a Roman coin had a certain value, it was expected to be of that certain value. So, that is to say, if you had a Roman aureus, a Roman gold coin, which was worth equivalent of 25 denarii, it would be expected that this coin would be made out of gold. In fact, the worth of the coin often was the gold itself. And the gold itself would have a certain weight and measure, which would standardized throughout the Republic and later the Empire itself. So this made trading and this made purchases and sales in the Roman Republic and later the Roman Empire very, very clear cut and very, very straightforward. If a merchant, say, during the height of the Roman Empire in 180 AD, if a merchant would, say, be selling something, let's say this merchant would be selling animal skins is a bit too open. Let's just say slaves. Slaves were very much used in the Roman Empire, and by our standards, it was horrific, but slaves were just a natural part of the Roman Empire, and a person was buying slaves for, say, let's say a gladiator, for example, which was a very highly valued slave. And this gladiator cost a certain amount of money, let's say four gold aureus coins. The person buying the, let's say, selling the slave in one of the far off provinces, maybe of Morocco today, could be assured that this is the same currency that he would be paying and using in Rome itself. So he had assurances from the Roman government that the weight and measure and standardization of the aureus of the gold coin he was using would have the same weight, measure, and standard of the aureus in Rome itself. And this is one of the reasons the Roman economy worked so well. There was a great faith in the system itself that this weight and measure could be used and accepted by all peoples in the empire. And not only that, the peoples that were not part of the empire itself could be assured that, for example, if this was a Roman gold coin, then an aureus, once again, that the weight and measure of the gold in the aureus itself would be accepted as gold anywhere in the world. So let's say if you were somebody from the Indian subcontinent, and Indians did trade quite a bit with the Romans, and they were buying something from a Roman, if they were selling something to a Roman and the Roman offered gold coins in exchange, well, the person purchasing them or using the gold coins as a means of exchange could be certain, or at least have a high belief, that the gold in these coins could be transferred out and they would be accepted anywhere. That is to say, if the coin itself may not have any value in the Indian subcontinent or perhaps even further east in China, but the person could at least be assured that the gold coin itself contained enough gold to make it to make the transaction acceptable across many countries that were not part of the empire itself. And this facilitated the trade and the economic development of the Republic and later the empire. Just like in our system today, individuals and peoples have to have faith and a belief that the monies they are using actually has some kind of intrinsic value. Otherwise, what's the point? It simply would not be used. So for centuries, this system worked, where these coins would have their not only the value of the currency itself within the Roman Empire, but also Roman Republican Empire, but also the belief by other peoples and the acceptance of other peoples that even if they weren't a part of the empire, the coins themselves carried a standard weight and measure of gold or silver or chalcum or bronze or what have you that could be used by other peoples as well. And this is accepted. Now, of course, there are some cases which we have heard, which are written down in the histories, of people what we would call debasing the currency. That is to say, just like today, you have fraudulent dollar bills, or we have dollar bills that are used by counterfeiters. That is a major problem in our society and the world society. So too, the Romans had that same problem where a coin that was supposed to be a gold coin of a certain weight and measure was not a gold coin. And so counterfeit currency would be passed off in the Roman world as well as it is today. And this created many problems because if you were an unsuspecting merchant or an unsuspecting buyer and you received these coins and you just had this belief that these coins were actually correct when they were not correct, well, you would be in for a big surprise when you tried to use these coins at a later time to purchase something else. So this was a problem within the Roman world itself, and also those that accepted and used Roman coins as value, as tokens of value. And the defraudment knowingly using these counterfeit currency would involve penalties in the Roman world, which were anywhere from what we would call corporal punishment, floggings, to have your liberty stripped to be sold into slavery, to outright death. And death in the Roman world was not a very pleasant experience. So counterfeit currency was a big problem in the Roman world, just like it's a big problem today. But for the Roman world as a whole, it became a serious problem when empires and emperors in the later age of the Roman Empire, for example, during the reign of Diocletian in the 3rd century AD, there was different types of coins that were introduced. And these coins did not have the value of the old coins. In other words, there was the idea that this different currency would be accepted, and it was not accepted as a whole by what was known as the Diocletian reforms. Furthermore, some of the issues that occurred during the late empire was that Rome, and this is true in today's world as well, the coins themselves were debased. That is to say, the currency was debased. What this meant was that instead of a coin which was supposed to be a pure gold coin, the coin had other metals that were introduced into it. So although it might have the same weight, it was not a pure gold coin, but it was what you might even call a legitimately counterfeit coin with other metals. What I mean by that is that if it was determined that you had to have 100 pounds of gold to make a certain amount of currency, well, if you had 100 pounds of gold and then debased the currency with 100 pounds of silver mixed in with this gold, the currency itself may have the same value in the Roman world itself, but because the coins themselves did not contain the actual amount of gold that they should have, other peoples may not accept this currency. And this is literally, as I said, the debasement of the currency, where the base of the currency is supposed to have a certain standard of metal inside of it, and usually gold or silver, these precious metals were accepted as currency all over the world. And then suddenly you find out that a Roman emperor had instead allowed the debasement of the currency, where the gold coin that was supposed to be 100% gold was actually maybe 25% gold and 75% silver or another value. Now, of course, this created the age-old problem of inflation, where you literally have too much money chasing too few goods. If, say, 20 years ago, a gold coin was a real gold coin, and then suddenly that same gold coin, the amount of gold in that gold coin could make 20 other coins because the coins were not pure gold, well, many people felt, and not without reason, that why would they accept the same, quote, gold, unquote, coin when it doesn't have the same amount of gold in it that it should have? So let's say something could be bought for one Roman aurus, one Roman gold coin. If the aurus did not have the equivalent amount of gold in it that it should have, it wouldn't be uncommon then to demand that five gold auruses would be used, because a person selling something would figure that five auruses would have the same amount of gold in them as one aurus would have centuries earlier, decades earlier. So in this case, literally you have too much money chasing too few goods. People were, of course, were not stupid back then, and just like they shouldn't be stupid just now. And this is one of the threats of inflation. Debasement of currency comes from many different reasons. It's not just as simple as a gold coin not having a certain amount of gold in it, which is accepted by everybody else. And so more coinage is demanded to pay for something than would have been required in the past. But once again, inflation occurred with the Romans just as it does for us now. And when emperors decided to debase the currency, many times they were unwittingly, you know, selling the seeds of their own destruction, and that the coinage and the economics of the Roman Empire was upended. And this created no ends of problems. And as I said, with the Diocletian reforms beginning in the 3rd century AD, this created many issues with the economics of the empire, in that it's impossible, or I should say it's a lot more difficult, to keep track of just how valued was the currency of the empire if nobody believed that the currency could be used to actually buy something in the future or buy something in the present times. And this, there's a lot of various economic reasons as to why inflation occurs, but certainly the debasement of the currency in the Roman Empire was one of the reasons the economics of the Roman Empire began to have really severe problems beginning in about the 3rd century AD. Now, Romans also had economic crises in their past as well. This wasn't the first time. But the debasement of the currency, this kind of fraudulent, when I say fraudulent, I'm saying it's state-sponsored fraud, in the sense that the empire itself, the government itself, is allowing the debasement of the currency. And it doesn't mean that, however, that people will not accept that the currency they're now using has the same currency as the value of the past. And furthermore, there are times where Romans try to institute price controls on their subjects, where they said, okay, this toga would be sold for so many denarii. It's going to be, we demand that the toga be sold for the same number of denarii, even though the currency itself is debased. Well, this created problems in the fact that many people didn't want to sell things at that point. If the price is limited and you know the money you're getting does not have the same value, well, that creates issues. So debasement of the currency. I would certainly argue this is fraud, even if it was state-sponsored fraud, in the sense that the money itself is not worth the same amount of money as it was, as it should have been. And this creates issues when the currency that's out there is intentionally debased. Now, fraud itself, as we've always discussed, is the use of misinformation or misdirection to take something from somebody who otherwise would not turn over the product. In this case, if it's the government demanding that the product be turned over, even though the currency itself is debased, I would argue that certainly if that's not fraud, it is a misapplication of standards. So there's an issue there. And another issue that occurred with fraud in the empire itself, and this occurred time and time again, and this still goes on in countries that don't have modern electronics for weighing systems, is that the scales themselves, when somebody bought something, obviously, you would weigh it out. So if you're buying a certain amount of grain, the amount of grain would be weighed out, and there are certain weights and measures that would be used to determine what were this, how much grain a person was buying or how much of a product a person was buying. So if there was a stone that was supposed to weigh exactly 1 pound, you would have a scale where on one side of the scale, the stone would be placed. That was 1 pound. And then you would put an amount of grain on the other side. And when the scales were balanced, well, that was or should be 1 pound of grain. Well, it wasn't uncommon, of course, for people to try and cheat their customers, and the scales would not be correct. Or you would have a stone where it was claimed that it weighed 1 pound when maybe it actually only weighed a half a pound. And so when the stone was placed on one end of the scale, on the other end of the scale, amount of grain that was placed on there should have been 1 pound, but instead it was only 8 ounces or half of what it should be. The buyer thought he was buying 1 pound of grain when actually he was being defrauded by the seller and he was only buying a half a pound of grain. So the use of incorrect weights and measures was very much a problem in Roman society, and it still goes on today, of course. But the standardization of weights and measures was very important in Roman society. And when somebody used incorrect weights and measures, and it could be shown that they used these incorrect weights and measures, once again, by having things where like a stone, which claimed to weigh a certain amount, actually weighed a different amount. Well, if this person could be shown that he knew about it, what we would call today having an intention or a mens rea, the correct intention of doing it, this was fraud. And this type of fraudulent inducement or fraudulent taking of materials from other people based on these incorrect weights and measures did carry not only civil penalties in the Roman Empire, but criminal in the Roman Republican Empire, but also criminal penalties as well. And once again, as discussed, the penalties in the Roman Empire, the criminal penalties included anything from corporal punishment or to a fine or to the loss of liberty through inducement of slavery or something even worse, execution. So incorrect weights and measures. The use of incorrect weights and measures, as happens today, certainly goes back to the Romans, and actually it goes back to the time of the Egyptians as well. It's probably one of the oldest frauds in existence, the use of incorrect weights and measures. Well, coming to the end of the podcast here, once again, I want to thank everybody for being with me. I very much apologize for the delay. Hopefully this will not happen again. I certainly will do my best to get the Halloween episode out next week before Halloween, which would be next Sunday would be the 29th. So maybe the 28th or 29th, we'll get that out there. Thank you very much once again. I hope everybody has a great week or had a great month, and we'll talk to you soon.